Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Sakevich. In this episode, I will be speaking with John Spencer, co-editor of Understanding Urban Warfare, alongside Lee and Collins. It was published by Howlgate Publishing Limited in 2022. John Spencer is an award-winning scholar, professor, author, combat veteran, and internationally recognized expert and advisor on urban warfare and other military-related topics. He serves as the chair of Urban Warfare Studies with the Madison Policy Forum. He recently served as the chair of Urban Warfare Studies at the Modern War Institute at West Point, co-director of the Urban Warfare Project, and host of the Urban Warfare Project podcast. John Spencer, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, usually we like to begin our interviews by asking our guests, tell us a little bit about yourself and what motivated you to work on this book.
Sure. So my name is John Spencer. I'm the chair of urban warfare studies at the Modern War Institute and at the Madison Policy Forum. I served 25 years in the U.S. Army with two combat deployments to Iraq, which were both 90% urban operations for over 2 years. And then about a decade ago, I started studying academically urban warfare as part of a think tank for the head general of the U.S. Army. And for a year, we studied, could the Army fight in a megacity or operate? Because often militaries get assigned everything from disaster relief to high-intensity combat. And then I was teaching at West Point, teaching military strategy, and we stood up a research center at West Point called the Modern War Institute. And as we were standing that up, I started to really focus on urban warfare and started writing about it, writing reports, doing research trips into combat areas. And then in 2018, I retired and stayed as the chair of urban warfare studies with the Modern War Institute. So now I have a dream job. I get to just solely write, think, do podcasts about urban warfare.
Yeah. You host your own podcasts as well. We'll get to that later on in the interview. But why is urban warfare so significant in the 21st century? Like you just mentioned, even how 80-90% of the operations you conducted in Iraq were urban related.
Yeah, and I know we'll talk about the trends. You know, the trends of warfare. I think why it's so significant is that militaries have always fought for cities. They have always been the strategic, such as if you want to take a country, you have to take the capital because it's the seat of political power, the seat of civil populations, the seat of the cities are the economic engines of nations. If you look across the spectrum of the history of war from castles, city-states to World War II, they're usually fighting for a city because it was the center of gravity of the political objective. But as the world changed, militaries found themselves increasingly fighting in cities. And that is just by multiple factors, the hardest place you could ask a military to conduct a military operation to achieve a political objective on the planet. And I'm not just you know, because I'm the urban guy, I firmly believe that, and hopefully I can justify why it is the hardest place on the planet to conduct military operations.
Yeah, and on the very first page of the book, you say that too often militaries actually are unprepared for the challenges of urban warfare, and I was really surprised. I think you were the one who mentioned that the U.S. Army doesn't even have an official training base for urban warfare, and I thought that was really strange because I got friends who do airsoft, and even they have like a whole complex for, you know, to simulate urban operations. But it's like, okay, so they could do it like in that context, but yet in the actual military, they don't have that. That was just very strange. But yeah, can you explain that? Like, why are military so unprepared?
Sure. I mean, the military, of course, has places in the desert, places in swampy woods where they build up a lot of buildings, you know, 20 to 500 buildings, and they have combat simulations in them. But the really reason why militaries find themselves unprepared for large-scale operations in populated cities, because you're not going to find a place on the planet that is just a bunch of buildings like we like to play airsoft or laser tag for the U.S. military, is because really across the history of warfare, the militaries have even written into their books, avoid and bypass cities at all costs. Militaries don't want to be sucked into urban terrain because it negates, one, what they want to do, which is destroy the enemy, and it actually reduces most of their capabilities. Sometimes people call, while I use it because it's a good way to just shorten the conversation, the great equalizer. So in the urban terrain, because of the physical, the buildings, the underground, the skyscrapers, the density of the buildings, it reduces things like airplanes can see from the sky, you know, satellite imagery, all these things. It allows somebody to hide in that terrain unlike any other environment, because concrete is, you know, a lot harder than woods or jungle, and it's going to be really hard to hit things in there. So it actually equalizes a lot of even the world's most advanced military's technologies in the urban terrain. So militaries plan to avoid it, bypass it, or they're holding on to a vision of a past war when there might have been big battles in the open areas. I personally think the age of open terrain warfare is dead. And nothing that I'm seeing in which I know we'll talk about in Ukraine or anywhere else in the world leads me to believe otherwise. All roads lead to urban. But militaries find themselves unprepared because it's really hard, like we were just saying, to train for urban warfare, given that, you know, you really can't, you know, take over Chicago and start doing a giant military exercise inside of it.
Yeah, and almost like how each city has its own personality, so to speak. Absolutely. So to speak. So yeah, and part of this was what you mentioned is the urban triad that kind of helps complicate things. What's the urban triad?
Sure. So by definition, usually when I talk to military people or even civilians, when I say urban warfare, they think about, you know, fighting in buildings, you know, you clearing rooms and that tough building to building, house to house fighting. But urban by definition, and we use the triad because it urban definition contains three things: the physical man-made structures on top of, you know, natural terrain, as in like the buildings, and the population by definition. To have urban, you have to have a population present, and the infrastructure to support that population. So, you know, physical buildings, people, and the infrastructure equals urban. So that's why if you just build some buildings out in the open area, that's not urban terrain. That's just buildings. So the urban triad is the way that the U.S. Army defines urban terrain.
Now, one thing I found really interesting about this book was that each chapter was not necessarily like the contributors like writing it out. It was actually you giving interviews to each of the contributors, and it was kind of interesting. Why did you choose that format?
So for a couple reasons. One, you know, I'm a student of urban warfare, although I have job security because most militaries around the world don't allow people to focus on one environment of the world. So I interview experts in a certain field, from smart cities to veterans of battles, so that I can learn. I'm also a huge fan of oral histories in the way that we tell stories. So absolutely, each chapter is an interview I did with an expert, and then heavily edited with intros and more research and maps and everything. But I wanted to hold on to that almost like storytelling element of gathering the nuggets of expertise from all these different experts to put it into a readable, you know, format that I think. So I usually say in my approach to studying urban warfare, there's two major problems. And that's really what why I titled the book Understanding Urban Warfare. There's two big problems. One is for the military or whoever it is to understand the city, because like you said, every city is unique. There's such a variety of cities based on why they are there, why they evolved, what they serve now to their local, regional, global environments. So you have to understand the city, and that's a whole field of study, right? Urban sciences is at most universities, urban planners, urban resilience, everything from smart cities to developing cities. Then the other problem is understanding how to accomplish a military operation, which is a great variety of really the science of warfare, the tactics, and all this that all change once you enter the urban environment. So that's why I wanted, with my co-author, wanted to stick to this format of really using my podcast interviews, which are research, and really turning those into hopefully readable chapters.
No, it was very readable, and I do encourage our listeners to please read it and also listen to your podcast, but we'll get to that. One of the major experts you had was David Kilcullen, who's actually one of the leading experts on counterinsurgency, and I think he's just about to come out with a new edition of his book, The Dragons and the Snakes, which actually... that's a whole nother discussion, but that also adds whole complexity to this issue. But yeah, he mentioned four mega trends that are kind of driving this emphasis on urban warfare, and maybe we could discuss them, because he lists population growth, urbanization, obviously, what he calls litterization, and then network connectivity. How did he explain that to you?
Sure. So David is a close friend, and he wrote a book called Out of the Mountains back in, I think it was 2016, which really, you know, took on these mega trends, these unescapable trends that the world must listen to, and militaries especially have to listen to achieve national interests, whatever those may be. So the first one is population growth. It's just fascinating, really. I love the numbers. So it took thousands of years for the human race to achieve 3 billion people on the planet. And that was in 1960 when we hit 3 billion. It took thousands of years to hit that point. Well, it only took 40 more years to double that to where we're at 6 billion. And now estimates are that by 2035, I think, we'll triple that 3 billion that it took thousands of years to get to. So the population growth of the planet is unescapable. You know, and most people understand, and that has impacts on the use of the land, climate change. It has such a impact on the world and the way we prepare for whatever it is, whether that's a natural disaster or a military operation. The other one is urbanization. So there's a lot more people on the planet. Well, those people are moving to urban terrain. 180,000 people move to a city a day. And that's a United Nations people that track this figure. And that's pretty mind-blowing in and of itself. I mean, it took, by 1950, only 30% of the world. So this is post-World War II. So most of the things we hold on about war really apply to World War II, right? In peer competition, fighting Russia, fighting China. It was in a world where only 30% of the world was urbanized. Well, by 2020, over 50%. Closer to 60% of the world was urbanized. And keep in mind that includes large swaths of the planet that aren't inhabitable, you know, or just not populated, like in Africa or the Arctic. Most of the developed world is over 80% urbanized. So urbanization is a massive trend that is increasing daily. So littoralization means that people live near coastlines. And that figure is a little harder to tie down, but I think it was over 40% when we were writing our books, live about 100 kilometers from a coastline. But if you think about it, most cities need some large body of water, whether that's a massive river like the Tigris or the Dnieper or, you name it, a large river, or they live along the coastline. It's just a part of the rise of civilizations, right, from Mesopotamia to today in most parts of the Pacific, where urbanization has exploded. So that's a significant consideration about people living on the coast. How are you going to enter an area, the impact of a natural disaster on the coastline? I mean, each one now is in the figures of billions of dollars, a single natural disaster, because it's along the coastlines. And then lastly, connectivity. And I wrote another book similar, with a similar vein, about connected soldiers. But connectivity means that the world is more connected. And even since I wrote in that book, written this book, which came out last month, things like Starlink, low orbit satellites, parts of the world that were never connected to even their nation, let alone the global community, are now connected. And all those connections matter in our, really our interdependency, our access to information, how political stability is or is not achieved. That connectedness is huge.
Now, how do different militaries kind of approach this issue? Because this issue was addressed in the book, like how the United States military, some of the other NATO allies, and also Russia, more specifically like the first and second Chechen wars, and a little bit of the Ukrainian war. We'll get to that a little bit later. But yeah, how's like a different approach from different militaries?
Yeah. So there are some intricacies in the way a military approaches how they design their military, what they plan to use their military for. Most Western militaries are either a part of the NATO alliance or expeditionary military. The one exception is like Israel, which approaches urban warfare a little different because they're not expeditionary. They're solely for defense, and they know which urban environments are most likely in which they'll be, where a Western military might not have that ability, and they have to prepare for global deployment. One of the differences, though, between, let's say, a Western military and a Russian military, and what we've seen play out, is that one of the reasons that I say urban warfare is the hardest to fight on the planet is because of the laws of war, the Geneva Conventions, everything post, even, the laws of war predate World War II, World War I, but, they have been strengthened, new laws, because the world doesn't want war to impact urban areas and civilians like it has in the past. So a Western military, if it goes into an urban area, is automatically going to be constrained on the use of force. So what it can do in an urban fight, how it has to have proportionality in what weapons it uses, the things it can and can't shoot at, protected populations, protected places, all a part of why it's so hard to fight or conduct operations in military terrain, because you're going to have more constraints than, let's say, you're in the jungle or winter warfare in the Arctic. Russia seems to not care as much about the rules of law or the laws of war, and fires at anything it wants, to include theaters full of children and hospitals and all these things that are protected by, that a Western military would automatically not use explosive force against, without going through the laws of war and proportionality, military necessity, all of these things. So that's one of the biggest differences in the way different countries approach urban warfare. But there are also a lot of similarities, to include unpreparedness. So that's one of the similarities, which is job security for me, which is, but I'm also the huge advocate. I've traveled the world training militaries on just how they think about urban fights, to include, which I know you'll probably ask me about, is one of the best predictors of the way we're going to fight or the fights that we're going to have are looking to the past and making sure we're grabbing the right lessons from past urban battles.
Yeah, there are several case studies in the book, and we'll get to those. But yeah, and another issue about urban environments is, of course, with the explosion of urbanization that we just discussed, you know, states or governments are having trouble kind of keeping control of them. And one of your guests came up with the concept of what he called feral cities. And what are those, and how does that have impact on urban operations?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was my friend Robert Norton, who's a professor at the Naval War College, that developed this concept called feral cities after he had visited many cities in which the government doesn't control power, may not even control services. Places around the world, you know, Mogadishu, Somalia was a great example, but lots of places in Latin America where you have a major city of millions of people, and you have large swaths of the city that aren't, there is no state control. So the power is actually with gangs and criminal groups and drug lords and things like that. So while it is a urban environment that is functioning, is feral, almost like a animal that, you know, that goes wild and loses its domestication. It's not controlled by state authorities. It's almost off on its own. So it's its own world. And he had a metric in which to assess a city, and you can have parts of a city that are feral and other parts that aren't. And I think even in the United States, we could say that there, at times, there have been parts of different cities that have gone, you know, rogue, have gone feral.
Yeah, and we talked about the networked connectivity, and how does that have an impact on, like, the urban environment and urban operations? Smart cities, as it's called in the book, what is the significance of that?
Sure. So there's a two-part question here. So smart city is a lot easier to answer. Smart city is, as the advancements in technologies to improve quality of life, a smart city by definition of the expert I interviewed was anyone that uses advanced technologies to improve the quality of life, whether that's traffic light sensors, all kinds of technologies to improve the quality of life for the city and the urban area. I mean, that what that means significant for everyone is that there's more sensors, right? There's more cameras, there's more technologies collecting with the intent to improve the urban environment. In military application, though, that second question about how does that connectivity and information, right? Information can be used to improve quality of life, and it can also be improved to contest power in an urban environment. So one of the theories about information is that in weak states where either it's a bad governance or a authoritarian dictatorship, is that once citizens have access to information, they learn more and it has, in some parts of the world, increased political instability. And that's what leads to, again, a military understanding a urban environment or a city and understanding how to accomplish a mission, even if it's restore order. In places like Rio de Janeiro, where the city went feral, as in the gangs controlled more of the city than the state did, so they implemented a policy where the military would take over control, which is what you don't want in a non-war environment. But that access, populations having access to information, governments want to stop that, and it's becoming increasingly hard for places like Iran and other parts of the world to keep their citizens, like China, unplugged from that connectivity, which is a rapidly almost uncontrollable global trend.
Yeah, and we're seeing this with the war in Ukraine, with like videos and all sorts of open source intelligence just all over the place being used. And so let's get to some of the historical case studies. The first one is the Battle of Ortona, which was in the Italian campaign during World War II. What is the significance of that case study for urban warfare studies?
So yeah, it's an amazing one. I just love case studies. Even in my field of urban warfare research, sometimes people will invoke a name of a city to say like Stalingrad. So I love doing the hard work of a case study, and it's really hard to summarize a battle. But for interestingly, for the Battle of Ortona, which I interviewed one of the world's leading experts, an actual friend of mine, Major Jason Giroux, who's a Canadian officer, because at that battle, it was the Canadian army against the German army defending urban terrain. There's really some fascinating aspects of the use of the natural terrain to create a very effective urban defense. And the Germans established, even to the surprise of the Allies and the surprise of the Canadians, a very effective defense on a piece of urban terrain that was already constraining based on the plateaus and the Italian geography. They did not understand the battle they were going into, but it's also a great example of how a effective, motivated, well-trained military like the Canadian Army was able to adapt very quickly and use some of their equipment in an abnormal way to achieve their goal, which was to liberate that city from German control. And it's a really great study on both how to build an effective defense, but also how to adapt quickly to overcome those advantages of an urban defense that the Germans tried to use.
Yeah, and I think that was on the Gustav line.
Yeah, the Gustav correct? Line. Absolutely.
Yeah, and that it took the Allies like a year to really punch through, and then more famously, you know, Battle of Monte Cassino, which they made use of the bombed out monastery. So
they call the Battle of Ortona, which I didn't know before studying it, as soon as it was happening, they started to call it the Little Stalingrad, or the Italian Stalingrad, actually.
That's very interesting. Now, the next case study was Mogadishu, which we kind of discussed a little bit. And this was kind of significant because this was probably one of the first major urban operations that the U.S. military faced, especially after the Cold War.
Yeah, it's a significant one in our own history. And like Ortona, I wanted to study. We don't own the ground of lessons learned from urban terrain. Absolutely not. And I try to study the entire history. Mogadishu, though, is almost another one of those legendary battles that, because of the fame of Black Hawk Down book, the Black Hawk Down movie, it actually had long-reaching effects on the psyche of the American system towards urban warfare. We interviewed three of the really prominent veterans of that battle, to include leadership, to understand the decisions that were made. So there's so many lessons here about ensuring that you understand the urban terrain, which was in Mogadishu was fascinating because of the Civil War, Mogadishu as a city changed overnight because 50,000 refugees moved into the city and started putting up temporary housing. So no map, no even satellite imagery would have let you understand even the roads, but also understanding that if you're going to do an urban operation, that planning and ensuring of all the necessary tools, which is a major lesson out of the Battle of Mogadishu that hopefully gets kept for a while, that if you're going to go into that dense of an urban terrain against that a contested enemy like that, there are tools like armor and fire support and things like that you need to have, which in that situation, the Rangers had requested, but again, all wars, politics by other means, the political apparatus said, no, that would be going against our policy of saying why we are there. So there in each one of these case studies, there's like little tactical, like from war fighting lessons. And then there are major strategic political lessons about ensuring everyone who's making decisions understands the mission that has been assigned to the military.
Yeah. And then the next couple of case studies are from the war in Iraq, which I'm sure was a little bit personal for you to have to research. And the first one that's mentioned is the Second Battle of Fallujah. And what was the significance of that battle?
So the 2004 Second Battle of Fallujah was a really interesting case study because a lot of people don't understand, again, one of the difficulties of urban warfare is time. Is that because of the intensity of the population, sometimes militaries don't have the time. Actually, and we didn't cover it in the book, I've recently covered it in the case study. It's hard to understand. All we do in the intro, try to understand the first Battle of Fallujah that happened in April of 2004, and then 9 months later, the second Battle of Fallujah that happened in November, is that a military actually can succeed very well in a major battle in a contested urban area with the right type of intelligence preparation of the battlefield, the right formations prepared for the challenges that are ahead, and that level of understanding. So in the second Battle of Fallujah, the U.S. military, the Marines, the Army, the Air Force, it was probably one of the most successful joint urban operations of the modern era. But the caveat is there is that they had 6 to 9 months to prepare for it, to ensure that they had set the conditions in the political environment, ensure that there was media coverage to cover the information battle. And we haven't talked about that yet, but another reason why urban warfare is hard is that there's lots of people there. The world is now watching because the world is connected. And that view of the military conducting the operation can bring a military either to a halt like it did in the first Battle of Fallujah, or if done correctly, can reinforce the just war aspects of the military mission that the military is doing in that city in general. And the city of Fallujah was to remove the terrorists that had used the city as a safe haven to conduct suicide attacks and many other bad things against the Iraqi government and the U.S. forces trying to help the Iraq government stand up a nation.
Yeah, and then there's also the overall political context in America because of the fierce debate about whether or not to even go into Iraq. And also 2004 was an election year. You know, Bush was running for re-election, and that was anything the military did would have impact on
yeah, and that. the timing is so interesting looking at these case studies of why that battle at that moment. But the timing of that battle, a lot of people don't remember either, is that there was also the Iraqi elections upcoming, and the governance at the time could not have a feral, ungoverned enemy city in its country as it's trying to hold a national election, because even the people of Fallujah couldn't have voted.
Yeah. And then the second case study from the Iraq War was the Battle of Ramadi.
Yeah, the Battle of Ramadi. Another fascinating one, which is, look, one of the reasons of the case studies is to show the military and to show the world there is more than one way to accomplish a mission in urban terrain. Ramadi is another example of actually the guidance given to the commanders of Ramadi was don't conduct another Fallujah, because the Battle of Fallujah was created a very destructive battle that had a lot of political implications. It did cause a lot of people around the world to question both the U.S. military's approach and the Iraqi government's ability to run a nation. So the guidance given to the commanders in Ramadi was don't pull a Fallujah. So they had to figure out a different way to rid the city of its terrorist influence in the violence that was happening in the city. So they used a different approach, which about basically securing a small part of the city and then extending security and governance by the Iraqi people in basically block to block, and basically over weeks and months using this format to gain back smaller and smaller sections of the city rather than encircling the city and clearing 68,000 houses in a matter of days like they did in the Battle of Fallujah. So it's another case study almost in relatively the same era of there's more than one way given all the variables, and time is always a variable. The political environment, because politicians set the objectives of the military. The military figure out how to do it under the guidance that they've been given.
And then the next one was the Battle of Sadr City, and I've been hearing a little bit of news about that being back in the news with some of the Iraqi elections.
Yeah, so the Battle of Sadr City, interestingly, was one I was in as a young infantry company commander. I never tried to rely on my own experiences. So I even interviewed one of my commanders in that situation to have a better understanding of things that even at the lower level you may not see. And, you know, I don't think personal experiences are always the best for understanding even a battle you were in. So the Battle of Sadr City was a fascinating battle in which a city of 2 million people within the city of Baghdad, so it's almost a city into itself, that was homogeneous of a Shia population. It was built by Saddam for the specific reason of putting the Shia population in it. That was led by a Shia cleric that has continued to be a problem for Iraq. Under his name is Muqtada al-Sadr. Before the operation of the Battle of Sadr City, the people were coming out of this city within a city and firing rockets at the Iraqi government in the Green Zone. So the military mission, our mission was to stop the rockets from coming out of the urban terrain. But you can't go into the city because of some things that had happened previously. Because of the political environment, the U.S. military was not allowed to go inside our city, but it had to stop the rockets from coming out of it. So one of the things that ended up happening over the days and weeks was to put a wall, a concrete wall, 8 feet tall, thousands of pound segments, and slowly over multiple weeks, put a wall around the city so that the enemy could not come out of the city with a rocket and launch it to a certain sites it needed. But it also ended up making the enemy give up the advantages of urban terrain because it came out to contest the wall being put in. And they would fire at the wall. Then that actually removes the enemy from all the restrictions on the use of force that is so hard in urban terrain to distinguish where the enemy is to ensure that it's not a civilian. So when an enemy comes out of his house, shoots at a wall being put up, then it's pretty easy to reduce the enemy's capabilities. So basically we did reverse siege warfare. We circumvented the city, which is a fascinating case study on, again, there's another way to achieve the military mission given all the variables of time, terrain, political environment, all of that.
And then the final Iraq case study was the Battle of Mosul. And this has been contested ground plenty of times in Iraq, including more recently with ISIS, I remember.
Yeah, so this is actually a conversation about the 2017 Battle of Mosul, which was another iconic battle where ISIS, you know, less than 5,000 ISIS had taken this city, a massive urban area of hundreds of thousands of people hostage, and they deemed it their caliphate. They were going to defend it to their death, and it took 100,000 security forces to encircle that city. Iraqi security forces backed by U.S. air power, the greatest air power in the world. It took them 9 months to liberate that city from ISIS. So there's a lot of lessons to learn in there that even with the most advanced weapons of the world, 80% of the city was destroyed in liberating it because an enemy who is prepared, and unfortunately ISIS had 2 years to prepare that battle for a defense. And they did it. They dug tunnels. They dug trench lines. They had multiple defensive barrier belts that made it so hard to liberate it. But the goal, of course, by the Iraqi government was to liberate it. But there's from tactical little lessons all the way up to the political environment about, you know, the longer you wait to make a decision on a battle like that, the harder it's going to be on the civilian population, on the actual infrastructure, on the military. I mean, the Iraqi military played a huge price to liberate Mosul, but it had to be done. It was a strategic objective that was the center of gravity of the ISIS terrorism because they viewed it as that urban terrain was the center of their, you know, fictitious caliphate.
Now, moving from Iraq, we go to, I believe, the Philippines with the Battle of Morawi, where the Philippine government has been facing an insurgency from ISIS and similar groups as well.
Yeah, so it's basically a similar construct to the 2017 Battle of Mosul, but like we were talking about earlier, is every city is different. The enemy in the city is different, but a similar situation. But in that situation, the Philippine military, like some militaries assume they can do, emptied the city of people. So 90% of the city of Mawari in the Philippines was emptied of the civilians, but there are still 1,000+ enemy fighters, ISIS fighters. But there are also differences in the battle because the Philippine military didn't have all the resources that the Iraqi military did, like tanks and other assets. But there are also some fascinating lessons from the Battle of Mawari on the power of information operations and maintaining the narrative. So the Philippine government and through the military spent a lot of resources and a lot of time and manpower to ensure that they maintained the moral high ground in the country, in the nation, in the globe to why that operation was happening. It was because ISIS was holding the ground from the actual population and causing that operation to happen. But it's another view of how destructive urban warfare can be when you have an enemy who's willing to die for every building, who has an underground network, where you have even, you were training for jungle operations your entire career up until that moment. It's pretty, a lot of fascinating lessons there.
And then we move to the war between Armenia and Azerbaijan in 2020 and the Battle of Shusha. That kind of got a bit of news at the time, I quite remember, aside from the pandemic.
Yeah, so the second Battle of Nagorno-Karabakh, which when I tell people, they're like, what? But in between Armenia and Azerbaijan, there is a contested area that's been contested for decades. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, it's a very heavily contested area between the two. So it's been basically a militarized zone, a space between the two countries. And in 2020, a war began over that terrain, and Azerbaijan penetrated the DMZ to liberate Nagorno-Karabakh, which it viewed as theirs. I went and traveled that battleground to study that war, because even though it had a lot of reporting about the effectiveness of drones and drone warfare and that you can't hide on the battlefield, the future of war is about these robots and these drones and killer drones. What I saw from reporting and why I went there was that the entire war ended over one city, the city of Shusha. Which, unlike every city matters, this city sits on top of a 400-foot cliff. It's a fortress city, and the Azerbaijanis snuck into the city without a major fight by scaling, not with ropes or anything, but walking up a cliff to infiltrate or sneak into the city so that the defenders, most of their plan to fight was over because the enemy's already, the attacker's already inside the city. So like a Trojan horse. But then what's important about that battle is that the war ended once that city had fallen. It was the strategic and decisive battle. And I went to travel that ground to see how a city that should have been defendable for months, if not years, fell in a matter of days based on the planning and the execution of a course of action that – instead of I think there's a classic approach that people think that if there's a city, you got to surround the city and you got to have this long destroy the city to save it, which is a saying that came out of the Vietnam War that I use often. That's not necessarily true. Every city is different. All the variables in which the military, and that's why understanding is the most important part.
Yeah, and what are some critical lessons that militaries should learn when dealing with urban operations? And of course, as we've been discussing, each case is different, so there's not a one size fits all approach. But what are some major lessons they should keep in mind when planning or executing urban operations?
So there's a lot of lessons. And this is why you mentioned at the very beginning of the podcast, and we point out in the book that there's, because of the cultural desire by militaries to not fight in urban areas, there is no There are schools about shooting and breaching in urban terrain, like you said, the laser tag and the paintball kind of scenarios, but there's no research center. There's no school on teaching how to plan for urban operations. And most of these case studies, I'm pretty much of an advocate that a lot of the winning or losing a battle happens in planning for it, understanding the lessons and the requirements to conduct whatever the mission is. And I mean, this is the difficulty of being in the military. You have to be prepared for a wide range of operations, from disaster relief to taking a capital city to achieve your political objective, which is regime change, much like Russia did in Ukraine and failed at the Battle of Kyiv. Some of the lessons are that, you know, urban warfare is not an infantryman fight. It's not about clearing rooms. It's a, like in the Second Battle of Fallujah, the biggest lesson there is that modern urban warfare is a joint, as in it requires Army, Marines, Air Force, even Navy if it's a littoral city. It's a joint operation. It's a combined arms operation. It's not just infantry, but, you know, the military needs tanks. And no matter what anybody tells you, the tank is not dead. In urban, I a really good podcast I did with an Israeli general is only an idiot goes into an urban fight without a tank, because there's no replacement for that mobile protected firepower. So in these case studies, militaries should learn that in urban warfare, you need combined arms. You need engineers, armor, infantry, fires. You need it all. And that's usually who wins and can overcome the equalizing effect of the urban terrain is the military who can combine, who has planned for it. I mean, there are also general rules of thumb that in urban operations, you know, you need five times the, if you're attacking, what the defender has, as in combat power. It requires more troops. You incur more casualties. You need more resources assigned to the information operations because of all those, that population and the world is watching. So there's just, you know, a book full of lessons that military should take about preparing for the most inevitable terrain that militaries will be employed around the world today and going into the future.
Now, of course, one ongoing case study is the war in Ukraine. And you, even in the summer of 2022, you went to Ukraine. What's been your impression so far, in your view, of the significance of urban operations with the war in Ukraine?
So that's another long list. And I don't want to be the guy who says I told you so. But so militaries do plan for different types of war. And one of the hardest things is to understand the war you're in. But we always say that the biggest thing that you have a military for is for defense, for protecting your interests against your biggest enemy, your what we call your peer competitor. Well, Russia invading Ukraine is since World War II, it is the biggest peer-on-peer battle or war that has been. So in the urban lessons is that when Russia decided to engage, basically launch an unlimited war for total regime change and wiping out the nation of Ukraine, it had one goal, one battle that mattered, and that's the capital city of Kyiv. So I went there to walk the ground to understand how Ukraine, in a single brigade of, you know, 4,000-ish Ukrainian soldiers and the Ukrainian people defeated the second on paper most powerful military from achieving its goal in war, which was to take the Ukrainian government and instill a Russian government and make Ukraine as a nation go away and it become a part of the Russian Federation, just a major part of Russia. They did it through urban terrain. They did it by the unique features that are the city of Kyiv, which is ancient city that dates well before Russia or Moscow or anything. It's an ancient city with some very unique features. And what the Ukrainians did was almost like ancient castle. They closed the gates to the city to buy them time, as Russia made a huge mistake of launching against all the cities of Ukraine or you know, like seven of them, instead of waiting their major objective, which was the city. So this is why I'm pretty adamant that cities are the strategic, operational, and tactical objectives in war. And in Ukraine, all these lessons we're talking about, urbanization, population growth, connectivity, has come out to fruition. I'm sure Russia wanted to avoid lots of the cities going to wherever they were told to go, but they couldn't. All roads lead to urban. I mean, there is a little bit element of terrain as they couldn't get off the road. So they had to pass through the urban. And Ukraine used their urban areas to effectively defend everything they held vital, which was their political seat of power, their populations, their military capabilities. Now, the Battle of Kyiv, you know, the war didn't end, but the war was over for Russia as in achieving that goal. So it, like in wars, it changed its goals for eastern part of Ukraine and for the southern part. But then again, all the battles were about key pieces of urban terrain, logistical hubs, you know, seats of regional or local authorities and power. So the battles of Severodonetsk, the battle of Mariupol, the battle of Kherson, they all had their unique case study features, but the lessons are all, to me, and I'm not just because I'm the urban guy, the war in Ukraine has been about urban, and militaries better be listening.
Yeah, especially in the case of Mariupol, even though the Ukrainians were completely surrounded, they were able to tie down like large numbers of Russian forces and even kind of hinder Russian communications from Crimea to the Donetsk regions as well.
Yeah, that's the case study I deeply desire to write. The Battle of Mariupol, where 3,000 Ukrainian defenders held down 20,000 Russian forces from moving to other parts of Ukraine to achieve their goals. They had a strategic, so you can lose a battle and still have a victory. So the fact that they held off, like Spartans at Thermopylae, held down for over 80 days, 20,000 Russian forces, is amazing. And it's because of the unique features of that urban terrain, right? The fact that it had these large steel factories with nuclear bunkers literally underneath them that allowed them to defend even longer than a normal urban defense against that disproportionate combat power ratios would allow you to, because they understood their urban terrain better than the Russians did.
Yeah, there was a recent interview with the commander of the Ukrainian Special Forces on War on the Rocks that he said, yeah, we know the terrain. We know the terrain much better than the Russians, and that is why we're able to, get the better of them on the battlefield.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you know, don't let my book not emphasize that some of the lessons of war, like urban terrain, are throughout the history. And in Ukraine, the other really predominant lesson is that the will of your soldiers to fight is as more important than the number of soldiers you have or the weapons you have. If your soldiers don't have the will to fight, if they're not fighting for a huge cause, for each other, for their families, for freedom, then you're already losing. And that's what you've seen in Ukraine. And that's why the Ukrainian Special Forces, to the defenders of Azovstal and Mariupol, to the defenders of Kyiv, have been able to do things that, which is really ironic, everybody, not everybody, but people thought like, oh, Ukraine is going to fall in 3 days. Well, one, you don't understand urban warfare. And two, you don't understand that the moral is to the physical, 3-1, as Napoleon said. You got to have the will to fight.
Yeah, and Clausewitz mentioned moral factors. I would also add, and I can do this with my grandmother who was Ukrainian, is just Ukrainians just have that fighting spirit. They just don't give up easily.
No, they've already, I hope this ages well, but Ukraine won this war a long time ago. Russia lost it. It lost it when it couldn't take the capital city, and it lost it when it didn't have the will to fight in its, not just its soldiers, but its population as well. Because like Clausewitz said, there's three major groups in any war. There's the military, of course, the ones fighting. There's the populations that support their military or don't support the military in the assigned mission they've been given. And of course, the political apparatus and its resiliency to support the operation and resist all other things and assign the right missions. If you don't have, Ukraine has all three of those aligned, and Russia has none of those.
Now, one interesting story in regards for you and Ukraine is you kind of wrote this mini manual for urban warfare that kind of became very popular in Ukraine, I heard. In fact, I even emailed you. It's like, oh, was this like a reference to the Margarita's famous mini manual?
Absolutely. So you caught that. I don't know if a lot of people did. So I have to state these disclaimers. I wrote that book with no affiliation to anybody, as an old guy who served a little time in the military and studied a little about urban warfare. But when Russia invaded Ukraine, I saw that the Ukrainian people asked their civilians to rise up and resist the Russian invasion, to fight for their freedom. It literally calls across the radio was to go out and resist, really make a Molotov cocktail, go out and resist. So I felt I could do a little bit better than that. So I started writing tweets on what I would do as an urban warfare scholar in the tactics that have worked across time, like in major battles, like the Battle of Seoul or Tona, like all these lessons that I've picked up about how to defend urban terrain. I started putting out tweets. The tweets became the manual that is the mini manual for the urban defender. That the once it started to build by March, early the first weeks of March, it was a full manual. The Ukrainian government, without me knowing, picked it up, translated it to Ukrainian, put it on their website for resistors, and then published hundreds of thousands of copies and distributed it across the entire country to allow them to do, you know, what is the one of the few revolutions in military affairs is the levée en masse. When you use you ask your citizens to fight for their nation. And that's what Ukrainians did, but they didn't have time to train anybody. So just with a couple pictures, a couple instructions, and I'm hugely honored that that book was in Mariupol. I got pictures of the Ukrainian version that they printed off. When I went to Kyiv, I actually got one for myself. I'm hugely honored that, look, if you understand how to use the urban terrain, you can do amazing things if you have motivated people willing to fight. But you also need to, you know, one, give them a weapon, which the Ukrainians did, right? They handed out 20,000 AK-47s in the city of Kyiv in one day. It's going to be really hard for any military, to include the best military in the world, to deal with that.
Yeah, I've even heard about how stockpiles of even like old Mosin Nagants from World War II are being distributed. And it's like, well, hey, whatever works.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Now, you actually host your own podcast with the Urban Warfare Project. Can you tell our listeners about that? And yes, there will be a link to it. I will urge our listeners to listen to it.
Sure. So a labor of love for me is my own podcast, Urban Warfare Project, which is on iTunes, Stitcher, all of them, which for years now I've been doing and interviewing experts on some feature of understanding a city or some veterans of battles or fellow urban scholars about the unique field of urban operations. Because I interview even police chiefs on how to secure a city, because the divide between political stability and instability in war and peace in urban areas, it can be a fine line. So the more I understand, the better I become as a student of it. And I just share it with everybody through the fact that I do it through podcasts.
So do you have any final thoughts? We're kind of reaching the end of this very interesting discussion, but do you have any final thoughts?
No, I really appreciate, I hope the listeners get a lot out of this, pick up the book. It's on Amazon. You can get a signed copy from my website, johnspencheronline.com. But I'm pretty much I'm adamant. Like, I don't know everything. I learn something new every day, but something that I do know is that the present status of war is that it's urban, and the future of war is that it's urban.
Very fascinating. We usually like to end our podcast by asking our guests, what are you working on now? And we did kind of get a little taste of that.
Sure. So one of the bigger things that I'm working on that we didn't talk about is just continuing those case studies. So me and my brother from another mother at this point, Major Jason Drew, we write these case studies and we post them on the Modern War Modern War Institute website. We just finished one on the First Battle of Fallujah, which is not in the book. We'll do another one, a little deeper dive on the Second Battle of Fallujah. But there's so many that I'm fascinated by, like Mariupol, that we're going to continue to write in those case studies. And eventually those case studies will also become another book. I'm thinking, I haven't talked to Jason, but I want to call it Concrete Wars because that's what it's about.
Very nice. Maybe when you finish that, we could have you back on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
John Spencer, thank you for joining us on the New Books Network.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Sakevich. Until next time.